Okay, so today we have Paul Arnold and Andrew Barnabas, who are more popularly known as Bob and Barn. So the first question I thought I'd ask is, since Andrew Barnabas and Barn kind of make so much sense, where does the Bob come from with Paul?
Well, that's okay. Really for Barn to answer, actually.
That
he's
really
responsible
is
for
my
that.
Fault, simply because when we employed because I was the kind of the first sound person. Music sound is a person at Millennium Interactive, and Paul was the second. I decided to carry on a tradition for when I was studying A level music that we decided that we were going to call whoever was teaching us Bob. Doesn't matter if their name or whatever, just call them Bob. So I made sure that when Paul joined, I said, like, no, actually, no, he's known as Bob. And I knew that I had succeeded when the boss's boss went up to my boss and said, how's the new guy Bob doing? About a month after we started. So I was like, yep, I think I have succeeded here. So I was simply basically following a tradition from A-level music.
So it's like an official title kind of thing, then?
Yeah, it's like some kind of alter ego that follows me through life, and I don't know who I am these days.
So there is an identity crisis going on in the Bob and Barn
camp. Yeah, I think so. There are people who have called up my house, where I used to live in a shared house, called up and asked for Bob, and they've gone, yeah, there isn't anyone called Bob who lives here. So, yeah, it's been a permanent point of confusion in my life.
In fact, I did that a couple of times. I said, can I speak to Bob, please? I went, there's no Bob here. Then it went quiet. I went, Paul, phone for you. I went, yes, results. It has indeed worked.
I was going to say, I hope you haven't missed out on any work through that.
No, I don't think so. I hope not.
Actually, I'm going to tweak my microphone settings because that was a little bit loud, that bit there. Anyway, carry on.
That's okay. I've been peeking a little bit myself. I mean, it's all live, everything this, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So before we do jump into all the medieval stuff, I was intrigued about the two of you, and because you've been such a collaborative force throughout both of your careers the whole time, really, I was intrigued on how the two of you came together and what kind of roles the two of you take in the collaboration.
You want to take this one, Bob?
I'll speak about that. We met working at Sony. Barn started in 1995. I started in 1996. And we met working there, and it started off initially Barn was meant to be doing all the music composition and I was meant to be taking on more of the sound design role and working on, you know, anything else that basically wasn't music. But I was trained in music and I always wanted to work in music, so I took an opportunity with some downtime and I got in the studio and I wrote something. It was kind of in the right vein for the world of medieval, and so it ended up going into the game, and our collaboration sort of started really from there, and we've been working together really ever since. We sort of worked at Sony for 5 years and then we went freelance in 2001. In terms of the roles that we both take, I'd say that it's... I mean, we both do everything. It's really a lame explanation. But the reality is that we both got strengths and weaknesses in different places. So, for example, Barn's well-versed in the world of jazz, and I'm more versed in the world of rock music. So we tend to come at music from different angles. So when we're genuinely collaborating and sitting in the same room, we'll probably see it in different ways. And that's often been a real advantage for us through the years. And we end up producing something together that neither one of us would produce independently. But at the same time, we often have crazy deadlines to hit. And working together has been an absolute godsend. I mean, right now, we're working on two TV shows and finishing off a feature film, as well as handling all of the press and PR for Medieval. So we would never be able to handle that kind of a workload if there was just one of us. So in that instance, we'll often agree a kind of a sound palette and themes and ideas so that we're both working from the same page. But then we'll work on different aspects of each project, you know, different cues in the film or you know, maybe I'll do a bed for the quiz show and Barn will do the titles or whatever, whatever falls right for us. So that's really worked very well for us over the years, and there's no real reason to change it.
It's interesting that you do mention that you guys do work so much in TV and in other mediums as well, because you do basically do it all. You're definitely not just games composers. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about or give your perspective on how you might approach game music differently to those other mediums.
Oh, okay. Well, I might as well jump in here. Well, the one thing which we always loved about doing our games is the fact that it's a constantly evolving beast. And it also it ticks the geek nerd box, and the way that as they've developed over the years, the technology has moved forward. The way that you can do so much more now than when I first started. When I started on the Commodore Amiga back in 1990, and at that point, the music was, as I lovingly describe it, it's an all icing on a visual cake. It sounds like it's a pretty little piece of music to accompany a level. But the music itself doesn't actually reflect what the player is doing. It's more of a, here's an ice level, here's a sand level, here's that kind of, here's something which hopefully sort of gives you the mood of that particular area. But initially there were a lot of things, file size limitations, how much RAM you could use. Over the years, these restrictions have kind of fallen away. And the technology has got so much better now, the fact that we can actually much better direct the music, can far better reflect what the player is doing on screen, because the technology is much better and it allows us, and the code is much better at analysing what the player is doing and then feeding that back to an audio engine or music engine in our case. And you can tell, because if you think about it, an overall thing, music generally is an emotion. You are painting the emotion of a scene as you would in a film or a TV show. So they're always the classic thing I find interesting to do is how does a bit of game code know what the player is feeling? And you can use various cheap methods to do that, such as, how much health the player has got, how many baddies the player is suddenly being swarmed by, and use these to kind of elicit roughly a, well, I think the player's going to be pretty much, he's going to be shitting himself at this point, so therefore let's make the music more active and a little bit more nervous and suspense. So these things have gone hand in hand over the last sort of 10, 15 years, where the music can much better reflect what the player is doing on screen. So that really is a fun place to be, because you can sit there and you work out and go, well, let's, rather than having one piece of music per level, you have lots and lots of different bits of music, stems, even some gluing things which will transition from a sort of exploration section to a suspense to an action and back and so on and so forth. So yeah, so that perspective, it's a very sort of challenging and rewarding technical exercise to get the music right in game, which is one of the things which I always point out, that unlike music for film and television, game audio is less post-production, whereas in a film or TV show you're generally waiting for what's called locked edit, where they picture lock, where they filmed everything, they've got an assembly, the effects and everything else, and the grading might not be in, but in terms of the pacing, That's pretty much set as it. So at that point, then we can sit there and go, "Hi, let's put it into our sequencer on our timeline, work out exactly the emotion, the contours of a scene, and score it appropriately." But with the game, you don't have that. Again, the player can be just dropped into a level, and they could go in any direction. And at one point, they might all be under attack. They might not be attacked. And I also think it's interesting that. What I find interesting about games is also a player can get all the way towards an end of a level and then right the final boss or something else get killed. Now, what you don't want then is the player to go back to the beginning of the level and hear the same thing again. So at that point, you're having to think, I suppose, vertically and horizontally on a timeline as to how to make the music evolve and so it doesn't sound like the same. Because that's one thing I've always found is something which is a bit of a bane. A bit of a stigma from older games is repetition. A lot of the whether it was limitation on technology, RAM, storage, whatever, it sometimes meant that there was no choice but you would hear the same piece of music time and time again, which I always think pulls you out of the experience, because you would never have that kind of thing in a film or TV show. Whereas now, it's a lot easier to develop these things and go, well, this time round, rather than just hearing, say, for example, the string, let's hear a bit of the strings and the woodwind. In fact, we'll lower the strings in volume. And so you feel like there's a sort of a progression and a transition, so it doesn't feel like it's exactly the same experience time and time again. Now, the technology for this has developed greatly in the last, I would say last probably 10, 15 years is the biggest leap. So, yeah, so that from that perspective, it's really good fun to try to elicit what can we now do with this to evoke the same emotions as we would do if we were doing a film and TV score. Does that answer your question? I forgot the initial question.
No, that was fantastic. And to hear a little bit about composing for film and TV as well, because that's not something I often touch on the show. And to hear about that growth of technology actually dovetails into what I wanted to move into next, because although, of course, we want to talk about the new medieval, some of my earliest gaming memories were playing the very first medieval. It actually means a lot to me, that very, very first one, the PlayStation. So I wanted to kind of, with this interview, kind of go through the medieval series as quickly as possible leading up to the new one. So with that technology in mind, I wondered if you could talk about, if you can remember, since it was that far back, the kind of processes and equipment you might have been using on that original medieval.
You want to take it in turns, Bob? You do medieval one, I'll do medieval two. There we go.
Yeah, all right. Well, I can speak on this. Medieval one was particularly interesting because we had ideas of how we wanted sound to be implemented. And this is not just about music. We sound designed that game as well. So right across the board, we wanted to have what is effectively now known as middleware. We wanted to have something that would allow us to change and vary the playback of the sound. So I remember we sat down with Chris Sorrell one day and we talked about the idea of having just pitch offsets so that we could have a single footstep stored in SoundRAM, and then it would randomly change the pitch of that in order to stop it sounding like a machine gun sound, entirely repetitive. And we had a few other suggestions, but it was like fairly basic stuff. Chris went away and wrote an unbelievably complex system running on PlayStation 1. It was just shocking to both of us that he'd gone to such a level of depth with splines within splines where you could do pitch bend over time and then loop sounds that would pitch over time and do a modulation within that. So we found that it just got our creative juices going, and we were able to do things like the health fountain sound, for example, is made out of one of the sounds that sort of goes as it comes in, as the spirits come in and go out. It's basically made out of that sound, pitched down two octaves or something, and some modulation effects put on it. It's all created at runtime by the game. And we've done that again on the new version of Medieval. While we were out in the States, we sat with the team, we talked about that, and we actually... all of us sat down and lovingly recreated these old retro sound effects using the WYs. So that was certainly its first incarnation. Musically, there wasn't really a lot to be said for that, because there was very little that we could do except for playback CD quality audio from the CD. And that was the first time we'd really had scope to do that. So it was a great opportunity. But there wasn't really anything that we could do interactively, though we would dearly have loved to have done it back in the day. So in the end, we came up with the idea that the music would kind of taper at the start up to a crescendo somewhere in the middle and then taper off again towards the end. And that the tracks would kind of sort of loop, although we knew that we couldn't seamlessly loop either. So they'd sort of come to an end and then re-trigger. And it really was as simple as that for Medieval One.
Okay, well, I'm going to jump into Medieval 2 then. The one thing which also I would say that the score, the music for Medieval 1, was the first time that we'd been asked to write music in an orchestral style. Prior to that, the music had been a little bit more, I say, traditional games type stuff. And because Chris Sorrell had such a... Chris Sorrell, the designer and the director of the game, he had a very clear vision of what the game should look like. And he took their visual references from Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, and also one of the kind of sort of the old Konami arcade games, sort of Ghouls and Ghosts and Ghosts and Goblins, sort of mixture of that. But on the flip side of that, it also meant that he was a big fan of Danny Elfman's rather iconic music from those films, from his Tim Burton's work. So then we had to like say, can you do something like this? And at that point, we sit there and go, okay. Fortunately for both of us, we were both musically trained, so could take some of his scores and analyse what makes a Danny Elfman score sound iconic and sound that wonderful sense of gothic comedy and humour, which just fits perfectly with those kind of visuals. Kind of worked out how that worked, sort of extrapolated a sort of a formula, and then tried to apply it with our incredibly limited resources. We literally had one synthesizer, a Roland JV1080, and one sampler, an Akai S3200. That was it. There was no other way of making orchestral sounds. So at that point then, you also find yourself composing to the strengths of the sounds you have. If you have a good string sample, you use those. If you've got bad brass samples, you kind of avoid using that. So you sort of come up with a palette of sounds which hopefully reflects the strengths and the sounds that you have. So then moving on to Medieval 2, following the same process, at that point we knew we'd learnt a lot about how to sort of write for a synthesised orchestra. We'd also managed to persuade Sony, bless them, to buy a wonderful new bit of kit. In fact, it was the Kurzweil K2500, which not only had great sounds internally, it also had a massive, huge 128 megabytes of RAM for loading samples in. So then we bought some new sample libraries, orchestral stuff. So our samples were already beginning to sound a lot more realistic. And I think actually it was Bob, I think, who found an article in a magazine called Future Music, which gave you some suggestions of how to write music for an orchestra using samplers. And one of the things it said was, for example, apply a low pass filter to the mod wheel, which basically meant that if you did things like you could make brass sound raspy and kind of warm and muffled, which is very good for things like French horns. So you can sort of like have a brass going, wah. I'm never doing that again. And just to make it sort of like sound much more convincing. So along with this new sound, setting everything else, and obviously we'd had the experience of learning how we'd done a medieval one. So hopefully it was an iterative process of how can we take this and improve our writing for Medieval 2. Another thing we did is that on the first game, we just called it Strings, things like that. And it was actually Bob's old housemate, now a very successful composer, who came over and said, actually, you don't want to be writing a pad, you know, a string sort of pad or legato line on just a patch called Strings. You want to be writing it for each section of the strings, your violin one, your violin two, your viola, your cello, and your bass. So again, now we have more RAM, now we have better samples, we could now do this. So all these sort of evolutionary steps that we took all helped make our scores, our synthesized orchestral scores, sound a lot more convincing. I mean, the only downside at that point is that this was still a PlayStation 1 game and we were still streaming from CD and we still couldn't do anything more interactive than here's a track, here's a level, play the track, and if you go to a boss track, swap to a boss track. That was pretty much the level of interactivity they could do. But the music sounded more realistic and hopefully we'd got better at writing for synthesized orchestras. So from that perspective, everything was an improvement. There you go, that's me on Medieval 2. You want to take Medieval PSP, Bob?
Yeah, well, the segue there would be we'd sort of reached the limit of what we could do, I think, with the samples and the samplers. What we wanted to do was to go to a full orchestra at that point. And, I mean, there weren't many projects getting recorded around that time. I mean, it certainly had happened, but it was rare. And we were very fortunate, actually, that, as luck would have it, Google revealed to Barn one day, whilst Googling around, that there was a guy who lived just down the road from us who fixed the orchestra in Prague. And it was just pure coincidence that he was nearby to us. So Barn dropped him a message and we found out all the facts and figures about, you know, what is required and what's involved with going and recording orchestras. And so this was around shortly after we'd gone freelance in 2001. And the first project that we actually managed to get recorded was Primal. So having then done that, when we came to do Medieval a few years later, Medieval PSP, Medieval Resurrection, we, of course, we wanted to replicate what we'd done on Primal and go out to Prague and do it again. And we got all the pieces in place. We got an orchestrator, and Nick Rain not only orchestrates for us, but he also conducts the orchestra. And so we managed to persuade Sony to put the budget together to go and record that. And so what we ended up doing for Resurrection was recording a lot of the old music live, but also at the same time there was a sort of feeling internally that some of the pieces weren't very strong and that they'd like to replace them. So I think Graveyard was one of them. Piers Jackson felt like there was a better one in there, and he wanted us to go off and reimagine the music for that level, which is what we ended up doing. It's kind of strange now, because if we fast forward to the new version, we really wanted to be a lot more faithful to the old game. So we've ended up kind of having access to two tracks that were both written for the Graveyard level, for example. And we've had to record the oldest one again in Prague in order to bring it up to date with the production quality of the newer one that we did for Resurrection. So it's been a kind of a funny journey in that respect. But I'd say that was the only really big change, because everything else, we were still very restricted in terms of the sound RAM that we could use. So while we were still sound designing Resurrection, we didn't have a lot of scope for doing more with the sound design. So again, things were still sampled very lowly at 11K and in some cases even 8K. That's pretty much it, really. That was the biggest change, really, was just doing the music live.
I think it says a lot by that point that even on the PSP, which was a handheld title, that they were given access to big orchestral scores. Yeah. About how much audio had changed by that point.
Oh, the irony was not lost on us. You know, we'd obviously tried to fight for having live orchestra on Medieval 1 and Medieval 2, and obviously there wasn't there. And we finally get the budget on Medieval PSP, and for the speakers the size of my phone. So yes, the irony was definitely not lost. And in fact, I will interject with one little story, is that how we managed to get the live budget for Primal. Because at that point, as Bob said, it was quite, it's 2002, which Primal was in fact Chris Sowell's sort of sequel to Medieval. It was a very different game, but it wasn't a sequel from that perspective, but it was his next title. And he was very keen to work with us as freelancers, because obviously he quite enjoyed the work that we'd done on Medieval. And we knew at the time, we thought, well, the only way forward really is to do this live. And but again, as he said, this was a very, you know, this is a very unusual thing to happen in 2002. You had the odd really big game in America doing it, but really not many other games had gone to the full extent of doing a live recording. And in fact, also sort of shot ourselves in the foot, because from the technology perspective, when we did the score for Medieval 2 and then moving the score to Medieval PSP, technology moved on, so our samples became significantly more realistic, because rather than loading samples into RAM, we could actually load samples into from a hard disk, and therefore they sounded a hell of a lot more realistic, because we had a lot more bandwidth, a lot more size. So it was like, guys, is your demo sound great? Or can we record it live now, please? So we then, well, what on earth can you do? So we thought, well, there's one way of doing it, is you sort of sit there and you play a tune, you know, before and after. Here's the synth version, here's the live version. Wow, doesn't it sound so much better? But I thought of sitting in a sweaty meeting room in the top floor of the building at Sony in the height of summer with no aircon. Wasn't going to be particularly appealing. But fortunately, Bob's old housemate, the same very successful composer friend, he had just earned his wings to record his first live score at Abbey Road. It wasn't a particularly big score. It was a genuinely big string section. But obviously the name Abbey Road, the pole and everything else, were like, I said, do you want to come along? I went, of course, we'd love to go to Abbey Road. Who wouldn't love to go to Abbey Road? And then we just turned around. Actually, can we bring someone with us? And he went, yeah, sure. At that point, We then went to the development director at the Sony Cambridge studio, Will Parkin, and just said, sort of dropped it into conversation. Just curious, we're going to go and attend a recording session, you know, with the guys. And would you any like to come? And of course, wonderfully, like we were, it appealed to the little boy inside all of us, going, I'd love to go to Abbey Road. And so he came along, and in fact, the vice president of Sony, a guy called Phil Harrison, also cleared his schedule that afternoon and came along. So that, I think, was a turning point, because I think, as the famous composer David Arnold once said, when you stand in a room and you hear an orchestra play, you cannot be helped but be moved by that much air being moved around. And it's very true. When you walk in the room and you sit there, you actually feel the music. There's a very big difference from just sitting there listening to it on speakers, you're actually feeling it and everything else. So when we sat there and we listened, I listened to his stuff, it sounded amazing. Within probably 10, 15 minutes, Phil Harrison just turned around and said, guys, let's go and talk numbers. I was like, yes, result. Of course, it then took another 6 weeks to actually confirm the budget. But once they did, we knew that hopefully, fingers crossed, we weren't going to F it up and hopefully do a good job, which, fingers crossed, we did. So, which then, as Bob said, this really helped when Medieval came around, PSP came around a couple of years later. We'd already set the precedent. Therefore, there was no way they could sit there and go, well, we understand how much better it's going to be. Go for it, boys.
It's the first time I thought about it, but actually, it's fair to say that Medieval actually has progressed every single time we've done it. You know, there's been a development in each cycle of the game, and it's moved forward in one sense, because now the big step up to Medieval, the remake Medieval this year, is that the music is now interactive, which is what we always wanted to do from day one. There's certainly an audience that's not desperately happy with that move. We've had some mail from people saying that they'd much prefer the music to not be interactive. And I suppose that's one of those things that, I mean, you can't please everybody with it. But, I mean, personally, we'd much prefer, as Barn said earlier, to not have music that's just repeating over and over again. For us, you know, having the music progress and more closely match the action on screen is more important. I mean, that's us flexing our muscles as composers, if you like. I mean, that's part of the job, and we wouldn't dream of doing, you know, any film work or TV work that didn't kind of match what was going on the screen. And now that the PlayStation 4 is fully able to do that, why wouldn't you? So anyway, that was just one extra little thing that, you know, the development this time was the interactivity.
Well, yeah, it's a real shame to hear that you've got those comments, actually, because as someone who runs a podcast about game music, I have quite an obsession about interactive music, and I think it is just about the most profound thing that separates game music to other mediums. So that is a real shame to hear that people are thinking that way, because a lot of my audience don't think that way.
Yeah, well, you can't please everybody. It's always going to be like that. And, you know, you make it sound better with a live orchestra. There's probably someone who's going to say, actually, I prefer the original recordings. And, you know, nostalgia is a very powerful thing. And I understand that. I understand that people like that. And actually, we threw some things into this score to help that. We downloaded the software version of that old synth that Barn talked about. And we used the patches from that to bring alive, you know, to bring back those memories, if you like, the musical memories for people. So we try to put something in there for everyone, because of course not everyone sees it the same way, and you just have to really go with your gut and do what you think is the best thing. And actually, we were very agreed with the interactive element with Sony right from day one. No one really questioned it. So, you know, it's probably a minority of people, but they are out there and they're very vocal about it. So it surprised us.
Well, how was it actually approached then? Because I know you mentioned WYs earlier on in this conversation. Were you using that as middleware, and what other kind of processes were in play?
Yes, basically. Well, actually, I mean, Sony bought Audio Kinetic, the company which makes WYs. I think it was actually earlier in the last couple of years. So it's become their de facto standard. Middleware, which to the uninitiated, yes, it is a sort of an API suite of tools. Because back in the day, when you started, right, you know, every company would have to develop its own music system and everything else. And then people realised actually that's incredibly complicated and time consuming and expensive. Why not buy something off the shelf? And so there were two standards which came out, WWISE and FMOD. And so WWISE became definitely more, I would say, more popular in this kind of work. So it was, okay, so this is where it became an interesting challenge. How do you take 21-year-old tracks which were not interactive and make them interactive, but yet retaining the same essence of what those original tracks were? Because I'll jump in now and say that when we did our first test track for the new game, it's about a year and a half ago now, we sort of took one of the original tracks, I think it was one of the Graveyard tunes, and then started with that. We sat down, both of us sat down together, and it was more like, literally it was like kind of riding a bike. You sort of sit there and go, oh, how do we do this? What can we do now? And after a while, we just bet both of us kept jumping down at the keyboard and go, I've got this idea. This. It literally was like the formula for Medieval just came flooding back. And so, we took an original tune. We took one of the first tunes we did for the game and then wrote an original tune after that as a sort of development. And the first feedback we got from Sony was like, first off, clearly we've got the right guys, because this is clearly a completely medieval track. But actually, we realise we need to be more nostalgic, more take into consideration that fans are going to want to hear the original music. So then at that point, we had to then go back and go, ooh. Because I was quite keen to write new music. I also knew, as a fan of a particular thing, I wouldn't want to hear someone just completely rehashing the same tunes again. So I knew that if I was in their people's shoes, I would like much prefer to hear new stuff. But there was a fine balance to be had, because the game itself is clearly a remake, so therefore the levels are not obviously identical, they have been upgraded, but generally they want to elicit the same feelings, and people have, as you say, this sort of nostalgic, rose-tinted glass view of what the music from the original game was, because they seem to quite like it. And so it was a case of, what can we do now to A, retain the essence, which actually we turned out was actually quite a lot easier than we thought, simply because what you could do is we realised you could strip out to almost nothing. You could literally be almost just like a top line, a lead melody. And because people had heard that so many times in the original game, that was in itself enough to retain the essence of what the original track was. However, what we could then do is we could then, everything underneath it, we could hopefully, in inverted commas, improve. That's the one thing as well, is that having done 20 years of music since the first game, one would hope that one has slightly improved at that point, at least learn a few things, and therefore we wanted to be able to apply the knowledge that we've acquired now to those old tracks. There were bits of it where we're like, well, I wouldn't do that again. And bits of it were like, oh my god, what was I thinking? That's crazy talk. But the combination of all that, it meant that actually we could hopefully take and improve these tracks. So once we then established what would be a good way to record this, the most important thing here now was recording it in stems, recording each of the sections of the orchestra separately, and in fact to the level of granularity where you would record, for example, instruments doing short rhythmic notes, and then have a separate session having the doing long legato passages. So there was a great deal of control you could have. I felt quite sorry for the poor mix guys, because these tracks were enormous. In fact, I got one of the mix engineers to say, I'm curious, just how big are these? How many channels are these? Can you send me a screenshot? And he goes, yes. The response I got was, it wouldn't fit on one screen. And he sent me 13 screen grabs, and it was the track had 331 channels of audio for one piece of music. And I was like, oh my God. So they had to then mix these down into just section stuff. So you had, yeah, sort of like, you know, a sort of stereo or quad pair of just string legato, string rhythmic, woodwind legato, and so on and so forth. So we had a great deal of control. We were also adding, as Bob talked about, the old sounds from our JV, some sounds that we were producing here ourselves. Another thing as well is that because the tracks weren't interactive, because we didn't know, in fact, many of the original tracks were written without even seeing the level, because the levels weren't ready when we were writing them. And so actually quite a lot of the music is quite slow, because we knew that the majority of the game is more exploratory, you've got the odd combat bit, but overall, so we kept the pacing of this music reasonably sort of, you know, not particularly quick. However, now, how do you take these? How do you take that and add levels of, you know, make it a little bit more intense if the player is being attacked? Being overwhelmed. And Bob had this wonderful idea of adding what we call a spiccato layer, which was a rhythmic layer. There would be instruments we were playing, kind of percussion instruments, tambourines, just adding a sort of a layer of rhythm underneath. But the spiccato layer, spiccato is a type of string playing, which is kind of very short, a little bit shorter than staccato notes. So it's like very rhythmic short notes. And you could add a sort of a double tempo. So the track went da 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 quite slow. You could have ba 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 underneath it, so it would fit in the same tempo, but it would feel twice as quick. So we added this to each of those I think pretty much every level we did, and then it was a case of choosing when this would come in. We experimented with trying to have it come in when a set number of enemies attacked you, but after a while that really kind of pissed you off, and the music became very disjointed. So it was a case of let's be a little more clever, experiment with how many, where do we do it here? Do we do it when each level attacks, you get attacked, or do you do it when the level progresses and it gets more difficult? So we ended up doing a little combination of the two. So as you progress through a level and you open a certain a door, which you know you're going to get attacked, then these extra layers will come in. And it also allowed us to have a scope where we could start to add alternate layers. Like I mentioned earlier, that you don't want, if you almost complete a level and then go back to the beginning because you died, you don't want to hear the same thing. So at that point, we could say, okay, well, this melody we've currently got on a cello, a solo cello, why don't we have it now on a flute or an oboe? And so subsequent iterations of the game, you would hear same melodies, but performed by different instruments. And with a combination of that and really stripping it down and having these percussion elements and little motifs and all that, effectively gave us enough scope to have the music sound quite varied as the level progressed.
And behind all of these granular elements that you talk about and these tiny, tiny layers, I assume a lot of the time is these actual physical players in Prague.
Yes, in fact, one of the things that we agreed to do, it was actually Sony's suggestion to us. We should actually say at this point, the Sony team had a massive involvement in this. They're absolutely amazing, the guys out there. And, you know, there were two or three guys who were doing all the mixing for it. There was Monty Mudd, who did most of the implementation, I think single-handedly. I don't know if anyone else was involved in that. But, I mean, they really, really helped to bring this new game to life. And they had a big hand in the whole process from day one. We discussed the whole process between us. And their suggestion was, when we go out to Prague, we should try wherever we can to record the elements separately. And they give them a lot more scope when they're mixing it and implementing it into the game to keep those elements separate and also get more mileage out of the music. So, you know, for example, have one pass with just the strings and then introduce the brass and the woodwinds afterwards. If you record everybody together in a room, you're going to get bleed on the mics from the woodwinds into the brass and the brass into the woodwinds and into the strings, and you know, you will never be able to separate them. So the only way you can get true separation on that is to record them in a separate session. So that's what we did, and it allowed them more scope for implementing it. But it also became a way more complicated jigsaw puzzle than it ever would have been in the first instance. And so, you know, hats off to those guys, because they pieced it all back together, and it must have taken a really, really long time.
So I was interested as well in if you could talk a little bit about what it's like to work with those players in Prague, because I know, as you mentioned, you have worked with them since Primal now, and it's been a repeated collaboration.
Yes, I suppose we have. We worked with them since 2002. In fact, it was Bob's very successful composer, ex-housemates, who suggested that if we ever do get the budget for a live orchestra, you need your posse. You need your posse. I mean, at that point, we were very used to doing everything ourselves, but he was completely right that we do need to hire specialists to do this. So yes, as Bob has already mentioned, we had Nick Rain, who was an absolutely wonderful orchestrator and conductor. James Fitzpatrick, who was the orchestral producer, he fixed all the players and he sat there and produced all the sessions. That's the one thing we've also realised very early on, that we are incapable of being particularly objective when we're sitting in the session, because it all sounds great. So just do it again, just play it again. But obviously, from their perspective, we need to be a lot more on board, no, on the ball as to what's right and what's wrong. You know, clarinets, tassets here, violins are too quiet there, and so on and so forth. And then we also have Jan Holtzner, who was their in-house engineer there, who was fabulous, and Gareth Williams, who was our music editor, who just takes it all together assembles all the edits into the right place and basically edits it and puts it all in time. So it's a wonderful team of people. Everyone basically taking your notes on a page and improving on them. So it's a great. So over the years we have, I think we've probably worked with them 10, maybe 12 times, I think now. It's become a sort of just de facto standard after a while. Because if you look at the cost of it, recording in London is, well, it's generally what people would love to do, because they say the best players are indeed over here, but it's also the most expensive. Our second option is to record over in America, which is sort of about, yeah. And then the third, sort of the cheapest of the options, is to record in Prague. So especially on projects which they haven't quite got the budget to do it properly, we'll definitely always say to them, look, we'll put quite a lot of what, we're happy to put some of our quite, you know, substantial part of our fee into recording this live, because we just know how much better it will sound. It also makes our lives a little bit easier, because when you're writing stuff these days, you know, it's easy to just plonk notes down and just sit there and play it. But that's all well and good. But then you have to go. But if you're not going to get the budget to go and get it recorded, you have to come back and do all the sort of, well, they're tedious, but very time-consuming, labour-intensive reprogramming of stuff to do all those wonderful edits and effects and everything else, and key switching and articulations, which would make your synthesised orchestral recordings sound far more convincing. But it's a very, very time-consuming thing to do, which is a hell of a lot easier to do if you don't have to do that. And so, just because when a string section will play a passage, they automatically phrase it properly, just because they're taught to do it. Whereas obviously a computer isn't, and we need to do all that phrasing ourselves. So from that perspective, there's a benefit from us, just in terms of a time perspective. But but the players in Prague, they're fabulous. In fact, I think every time I go over there, I recognise people who played on Primal, who played on this session 2019, so that's 17 years later. So the guys are brilliant. I mean, they are just seasoned film professionals, and I think a lot of the reasons why they got so good at their job is because James Fitzpatrick, who does all of our orchestral contracting and producing, he was a big part of a film music label called Silver Screen, who are well versed and well known for re-recording film scores. So they will do their own version of Jurassic Park and Star Wars and Superman and so on and so forth. So, and they've done hundreds of these over the years. I think they've done a few hundred film scores. So they are incredibly good at just nailing this kind of thing. In fact, interesting, I will put a little anecdote here now. What I found really interesting, in fact, the same thing happened last week, is that you can sit there and put a score in front of them, and it's going to be some incredibly colourful, complicated, flowery bits where they go moving all around, and they can sight read that. It's magic to me to watch them go, I don't know how on earth you do it. But ask them to sit there and go, bub, they can't get it right. It's the strangest thing, that there's something really weird about the way a string section, or even any parts of an orchestra, just the really simple, basic, on a beat rhythms, they struggle with. But this incredibly complicated flower bits, they fly through it without even thinking about it. So yeah, it's an interesting balancing act to find. But over the years, we've definitely got more acclimatized with them. We've got used to them. We know how the recording is set up. So our process, our pipeline of taking our original tracks, getting them orchestrated, getting them copied and printed out, and then getting recorded and edited and everything else, is reasonably well honed now. So from that perspective, it's great. We can sit there and send something off knowing full well that hopefully the scores are completely correct and everything else is right. It will just come back to us and it will just be the same thing, just a million times better.
Yeah, because of course medieval has always had that orchestral sound, even back before you actually had an orchestra. So my final question kind of applies to the whole series, and it's a kind of philosophical thought I had about the sound of it. And it's that, of course, medieval has always had a great sense of humour, and it's kind of a playful comedic game at times. But I found the music is actually super serious sometimes, and that actually underlines the comedy, because it's something I spoke to Portal's composer about, where he, which again is a comedic game, but he was specifically told not to be comedic in the music because it's funnier. And it kind of seems like something like that is going on in medieval as well, in that it's actually funnier and more comedic because the music seems to take this serious slant.
I'd say originally that may have been more by accident than deliberate, because we were writing the music for the game, and we were seeing, you know, early incarnations of levels, and we were seeing still images of artwork and so on. And we knew that it was very much centered around the look and feel of Nightmare Before Christmas. So Danny Elfman's music for that was very much a strong reference point. So when we started writing, we were kind of writing blind. We weren't sitting in the studio playing along with levels or doing anything like that. In fact, we didn't even have a specific idea in mind as to, you know, this music's definitely for that level or whatever. We were writing in a much more generic way. And that's for Medieval One, that's very much not what happened this time. When we were writing original pieces now, it was very much the case that we discussed it, and we collaborated with Sony, discussed exactly which levels that we felt were either weak or for some reason needed their own new piece. For example, the Lord Cardock battle. We just reused the Zarok's Lair music on Medieval One. And so what we wanted to do was to move forward and do something different there. So, you know, hence there was an opening for a new piece there. And in the end, I think in total there were four. I think the Ant Caves as well, it lent itself to having a new track written, because it was way more sound designed than anything else actually on the original game. And you know, we wanted the music to stand on its own and for it to be more musical. So again, there was another opening for a track there. So that's what happened on Medieval One, and there wasn't really, like I say, there wasn't really a strong, hard and fast plan. We'd write the pieces, and then we'd sit down and we'd discuss with the team, in particular Chris Sorrell, where he thought, did he like the track, and where did he see it applying it.
Yeah, I think it was, for me, it's more the fact that I think, yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It's the tone. We weren't entirely sure of the tone, and I don't think they were at the time, because we couldn't decide whether, you know, they didn't know where the barometer would sit. Would it be full-on comedy? Would it be full-on horror? So we had to sort of sit somewhere in the middle. As Bob said, there were certain levels in later, subsequent iterations of the game where we knew more about exactly what we were going to do. And therefore we could tailor, for example, I think it was there's a fairground level in Medieval 2. And we knew that was going to be a freak show and it was going to be comedy and more like you were playing fairground attractions. So we could be full-on comedy at that point. But there was a real question at the original part of the game. It was like, where does this sit? Totally. And because the game was developed in tandem with us doing the music. In fact, we didn't even know what level they were, because we couldn't even name the tracks for the particular level. We actually just called the MIG, which stood for Medieval In-Game, and hopefully at some point they would go, well, that would be good for that level, that would be good for that level. So totally, we are sort of sat in the middle. But I mean, I totally take your point then. In fact, I do something, I mean, it's something we've done subsequently, is that we do like writing music which juxtaposes humour with seriousness. And we've done that on films, done that on TV shows, and in some cases done it on games as well. So yeah, I think it is much better. I think you're right. I think it does really help the humour if you've got a completely comedic situation scored deadly seriously. I think that works. I think that works particularly well. But yeah, we have to hold our hands up and go, yeah, it wasn't kind of designed on Medieval. It was more of a fluke. But thank you. Totally. Clearly, it was totally deliberate.
No, I just love that image of Daniel Fortescue's, you know, that stupid skull head, but the perfect strings and brass behind it. It just accentuates it.
That's great. Well, I'm glad. I mean, that's the thing. Sometimes it's not all premeditated, and it's such a evolutionary process, putting a score to anything, whether it be a film, TV show, or a video game. And, you know, it gradually evolves over time, and some things happen by accident, some things are very much premeditated and planned, and sadly that was one of those things that was maybe a little bit more by luck than judgment.
Still, there seems to be plenty of planned and thought out stuff there. Like, it's great to hear about the interactive stuff that you brought in on this latest one.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it wasn't all fluke.
Just that one. Yeah, just that one little bit. Everything else you actually did.
Yes, yeah.
Well, guys, thank you very much for speaking to me today. This has been fantastic, and I'm sorry it's gone quite a lot longer than I think it was scheduled for.
No problem at all.
No problem.
I really appreciate it. It's been fantastic.
Always a pleasure.
Love to speak to you.